What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Real Bodybuilding Podcast. This is episode number 90, and I'm here with Dr. Brad Schoenfeld, PhD in exercise science, and he's going to help us learn a little bit more about what we're doing wrong in our bodybuilding careers. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I wanted to get you on because there is a lot of bro science out there, and I follow you on Instagram, and I notice you commenting on some of it sometimes, and you put up a lot of good studies and things like that. So I thought I'd get you on to kind of clear up some of the myths of bodybuilding in the bodybuilding world.
That's what I do. So I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So I want to get started with some of the basics. And one of the things that's always been a question that has arisen is protein and the amounts of protein and how much people should get in. What is too much? What is enough per meal? Those kind of things. So I guess we'll start there. Is it different for a natural lifter versus an enhanced lifter? And does it vary in whether somebody is an advanced lifter or a beginner?
Yeah, those are great questions. So I'll take the second question first. For a natural lifters, it's actually interesting that some studies show that you actually need somewhat less protein per day as you get more experience with resistance training. You'd think the opposite, but there is at least some evidence that your body gets more efficient at being able to use the proteins that you're taking in for building muscle. I still am not totally sold on some of that evidence, and I would say probably doesn't make that much of a difference. But I would also say it certainly wouldn't make you more needing, you wouldn't need more protein for more advanced. However, you might need more, and we published a paper fairly recently on this, if you are a hardcore bodybuilder and you're doing, especially with high volumes where there's a lot of turnover, at least hypothetically, you might need a somewhat higher protein. The general consensus is you need somewhere between 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram per day, which comes out to a little around a pound per, if you're in America, roughly 1 pound, a gram per pound of lean body mass, of lean weight, really. If you're asking about now natties versus enhanced, that's never been well studied, but it just makes sense. And from some of the bodybuilders I've worked with who are chemically enhanced, there does seem to be a benefit to taking somewhat more protein just because your body is able to synthesize more proteins and thus make use of the protein you're taking in. If you're asking for guidelines, there just aren't any evidence-based, research-based guidelines. So it's hard to give a real definite answer on that.
So if somebody says, like I used to tell people that I made some of my best gains, and this might, obviously this is going to sound like overkill, but I was all the way up to 2 grams per pound at one point in my career. There isn't really any way to refute that because there isn't really any studies on enhanced lifters at my level. So anecdotally, if I notice that I'm doing really well and I'm getting bigger and I'm getting stronger and all these things and all everything's pointing in the right direction, there's not really anybody that can say 2 grams is too much.
Yeah, it's a great point. So I think one of the things we want to start off by saying is that evidence, scientific evidence, research is limited. It, first of all, can only, in a general sense, can only provide you guidelines. And there's going to be gaps in the literature, particularly when we're talking about things like exercise science and nutritional science, because there's just so many things that aren't studied. And you just hit upon one of them. In particular to what you're saying, the other important thing to realize is that there is a very large inter-individual variance, meaning that when I do a study, let's say I carry out a study, which I do a lot of, you'll see differences. I'll give the same program to a group of people and some will gain almost nothing and some are gaining 20% increase in muscle. So what we report in research are the averages, but the averages just basically, if you add everyone up and then divide by the number of subjects, you get an average. You're not an average. And ultimately we can give you guidelines through research, but like you said, number one, there's never been research on that. And number two, there's going to be a high inter-individual variance. So what we need to do is to ultimately, everyone needs to be their own experiment. You need to take what we know from the literature, understand the limitations. And in this case, there's really no good guidelines for you to go by if you're a chemically enhanced lifter. and certainly a high level bodybuilder, and then use your own judgment. You got to experiment.
It's something I'm really glad you got into, and we were going to talk about this. So we'll get back, we'll go back to the protein afterwards. But now that we're onto this subject, I kind of tell people all the time, actually, what you just said is your own experiment. And I've, you know, I've heard Seth Ferrosi say the same thing, and it's because we're kind of working through things as we go. And I just wonder how much variance there is between the scientific literature and day-to-day operate. Like, there are some people who won't do anything if they can't find it in a study. And I feel like, okay, but if it's working in the gym for me and you can't find the study, should I stop doing it? So I kind of wanted to have you on partially to explain to people that there's not a study for everything, I guess.
Well, not only is there not, that's a really great point. Not only is there not a study for everything, but even when you look at the combination of all studies, which is what you want to do. So I think an important point here is that someone who's evidence-based, and I consider myself an evidence-based practitioner, and we have a movement for evidence-based fitness. Mm-hmm. Evidence-based fitness is not just looking to research. It is taking the research that we have, making guidelines out of them, understanding the limitations within these guidelines, then using your personal expertise in combination with whoever the individual is, whether it's yourself or someone that you're coaching or consulting with. And that's how you form this evidence-based approach. So it's a three-pronged position here. And there are huge variances, and it would depend upon what the topic is. The more evidence you have, the more confidence you can have in your guidelines. But even with the best evidence that we have in guidelines, there's always going to be variances that need to be taken into account, and you always will need to target an N, basically have an N equals one experiment with everyone. So we use this basically, if we have good confidence in the evidence, we'll say, all right, here is, we can, let's say you're talking about volume. We could say, all right, we're going to start off with X number of sets based on the studies that we've seen, but you might not, you might need X plus number of sets, or you might need X minus number of sets based upon your response and lifestyle factors and other things, genetics, et cetera.
Yeah. So if you're working with an athlete and you have your set of guidelines or have the research you've done, and you're working with this person on whatever it may be, their diet, their training, whatever it is, and they come to you and they say, Brad, I'm noticing this. It works better when I don't do it the way we prescribed or whatever. Are you able to just factor that into your research, or do you say, no, let's stick to what the research says? Like, are you open to changing things based on what the athlete's telling you?
Well, that's exactly what I said before, is that absolutely, that the research is just going to provide your basis, your guidelines. So here's what I'd say too. There's two, you talk about two camps. There are, you have your hardcore bodybuilders or strength coaches, whatever, and who say, you know what, research is crap. I live it. I do what I do. And that's just as misguided as the researchers who say, I'm just going to stick completely to the research. They are synergistic. Yeah. If you are one who denies the other is really misguided. They are, they're swimming in a dark sea, basically. So you can, if you have research as your underpinnings to provide guidelines, it's going to get you into a ballpark where you can make more intelligent decisions as to how to proceed based upon your own knowledge, what you've been doing, as well as what the individual. So if it's yourself, then you have to take your own, what you feel for yourself. Or if it's someone you're working with, like I do when I've consulted with bodybuilders, I need to know what their response is. You want to know their experiences, because that if you don't factor that in, you're just not a good coach.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go to some bodybuilding myths that I think science is disproven, or I don't know how to put it, but let's say morning cardio, for example. I love doing morning cardio. I won't go as far as saying it's better and it'll get you leaner faster, but in my experience, it has. So where does that, and I know the science doesn't say that. The science says, no, it doesn't matter what time of day you do it. You're burning calories, and that's, you know, that's really it. Where, how do I mix that? Like, how do I figure that out? How do I say, but wait a minute, I feel this way. This makes me feel better. I feel like I'm getting leaner faster, but they're telling me it doesn't matter.
So a couple things. That is, that happens to be a topic where we have quite good basic research as well as some applied research. I've actually carried it out, and there does not seem to be a fat burning benefit to it. However, this is what we talked about earlier. The studies have been, we don't have studies in lean bodybuilders. So I could say with a high degree of confidence that if you are your average Joe, who's, let's say, got 10 pounds to lose, or, you know, isn't, let's say they're 20% body fat, it's not going to make any difference. Now, if you want to do it, if you like training in the morning, and there's a, it gives you more psychological benefit or whatever, there's nothing wrong with it. So I'd encourage you. However, we don't have any evidence, let's say, in very lean bodybuilders. I cannot rule out that if you are 6% body fat and need to get down to 5% body fat, that it might give you that extra edge, that there might be some basis to that. And I would say then it's worth experimenting if you feel that that's working. Now, again, the thing you have to consider when you say, I feel it's working, you have to look at what your measures are. Mm-hmm. How objective, the one thing we do in research and why it's very effective is that we look to control all the variables.
Yeah.
That can be difficult. And I think I don't want to go down that. That's a slippery road to start talking about. We could talk for an hour just on the pratfalls of research, but you get better, at least better control where we start to control other variables, where with the average guy who's doing it, or even let's say a high level bodybuilder, you're changing other factors. You're not isolating just your fasted cardio. If you are, you might be able to get a better sense of it. But it's not going to hurt. So that would be where I'd say, look, it's not going to hurt you. Might it benefit you? Yeah. If it does, I can say with a high degree of confidence, it would have a small benefit.
Yeah.
But that could be the difference between winning and losing a bodybuilding comp. So that really, I think, is the essence, again, of evidence-based practice, where you're going to use the research. And then that's going to, the way you then convey it would be specific to the individual.
Yeah. So why, can I ask you, there's this thing keeps coming up all the time whenever I talk to anybody about bodybuilding studies, and that there are none. Is it not valuable enough because there's such a small number of people like me, or is it, why is there no studies done on guys that are, I guess, bigger or leaner or whatever the case may be?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about pro bodybuilders, first of all, I've carried out a couple of studies in a concert with colleagues in Brazil on very high level bodybuilders, but they're scarce. So let me ask you, Fuad, if I said to you, Fuad, I have this great study, you're going to have to, for the next 10 weeks, just do X workout, you know, that's a canned workout. Are you going to say, you know, hey, sign me up for that? It's just with bodybuilders, you're, you know, they're so focused on optimizing their own body. And there's not that many of them too. So let's say, all right, you're going to say, you know what, I can deal with 10 weeks. Where am I finding 20 or 30 of you that's going to agree to do that?
Yeah. So. Yeah. It makes sense. Okay. Going back to the protein, I do want to cover one thing that has been a topic of conversation. The amount of protein per meal, does it matter? And should some meals have more protein than others?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually collaborated on a paper on a paper about that topic. And so there's two factors. Number one, there's this myth that you can only absorb 20 to 30 grams of protein in a sitting. You can absorb as much protein basically as you take in. Absorption simply means getting the amino acids from your gut into your circulatory system. Okay. And that's virtually unlimited. The question is, how much can you utilize for muscle building purposes? And there does seem to be somewhat of a cap on that. But the studies to date that have looked at that are somewhat flawed because, so I'll give you a, for instance, and this is where you can see when you actually get into the specifics of the studies, you need to really understand how research is carried out. So the studies that show this limit to what you can use generally are using isolated whey protein without any other food coming in. Okay. So they're going to get someone in fasted. They'll bring them into the lab completely fasted. Then they're going to provide them with protein and track their muscle protein synthesis over the course of a day. Now, we know that whey protein, number one, is a fast-acting protein. It gets absorbed very quickly into the system and gets utilize quickly. So you're going to have, if you're having a lot of it, it's going to tend to get, the excess will get oxidized more readily. Mm-hmm. Okay. Whereas if you are taking in, let's say, even a casein, which clumps in the stomach and is going to be utilized over a much longer time period, where whey might be, let's say, an hour and a half, casein would be 4 or 5 hours where it's going to get utilized. You wouldn't have as much oxidation. When you take in carbs and fats along with the protein, as most people do, again, it's going to slow down the transit in the gut and thus introduce it much more slowly. So there's not been great research on this. There's been some research showing that even up to, let's say, 70 grams in a sitting has at least some, certainly it doesn't cause negative, you're not, it doesn't look like it's having detrimental effects on the utilization, but you know, it certainly levels off. So the general rule that I would say would be to space out your, if you're looking to maximize muscle protein synthesis and muscle development, would be to evenly space out your protein intake over 4 meals.
Okay.
Now, most bodybuilders are going to probably be eating more than that, but you know, some wouldn't. If you're going to have 4 meals, let's say you're going to go for 2 grams per kilogram, that would be 0.5 grams per meal that you'd want to take in. And I think that at least gives you the it kind of errs on the side of caution of not oxidizing some of the aminos.
Mm-hmm. Is there a benefit to doing 6 meals or 7 meals? I mean, if you're telling me that I can get in a gram per pound of protein, is it better to do it 3 meals or is it better to do it in 6 meals? Does it matter?
Seems that 4 would probably be a kind of a sweet spot there. Doing it more isn't beneficial. It's probably not going to hurt, as long as you're taking in sufficient protein. If you're taking in suboptimal protein, there's something called a leucine threshold. Leucine is one of the branched chain amino acids. It's an essential amino acid. And basically a leucine kickstarts the muscle protein synthetic response. If your leucine level is low, you do not kickstart that process. And it's not going to be, if you're a meat eater, it's, again, it starts, here's where there are some, flies in the ointment. If you're a vegan bodybuilder, if you're taking in vegetable proteins, you're going to need more. If you're not taking in as much, if you're a if you're an enhanced bodybuilder, you're going to be needing more protein, and there might be then a benefit to spreading out the meals over more more frequent meals, because your body would be synthesizing more, and you'd have less probability of oxidizing those proteins.
I mean, that was kind of my point. So if I was getting in 4 meals, and I'm done eating my meals by, let's say I start at 9 a.m. and I eat every couple hours, I'm done eating my meals by, I don't know, 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. If I have the rest of the night to go, if I go to bed at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, it's not really going to benefit me not to eat anything for those 4 or 5 hours, right?
Yeah. So there is some evidence actually that there's, like, having nighttime protein enhanced, like if you have casein, let's say right before you go to bed, it's going to keep the anabolic response going. It doesn't, if you're, again, taking in, it really is going to be dependent on your overall protein intake, because as long as you're spreading out your protein across the day, it doesn't seem that taking then, let's say, a pre-bedtime protein meal has any additive effects, provided you're getting that 2.0, 2.2 grams. And if you're enhanced, somewhat more than that.
Yeah.
But again, we don't have any studies in high-level bodybuilders on that. So could that be where you're, let's say if you're on gear and that your body synthesizes proteins at a much more rapid rate, that you would be able to synthesize more during sleep?
Mm-hmm.
That's a topic that hasn't been studied, and it's not going to hurt you. So my general rule of thumb is that look at the data, but then also understand that what the limitations are in the data. If it's not going to hurt, it might help.
Yeah.
I'm a bodybuilder. I would recommend doing it.
Yeah. I wasn't as concerned with the pre-bed meal as I was. What's the amount of time that somebody can go before they become catabolic?
Generally 4 to 5 hours or so is a protein rich meal. The anabolic effects last about 4 to 5 hours or so. So let's say you're spacing out your meals to four. That's why I said 4 meals. So let's say you have 7 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and then 7 o'clock, you're getting in all your meals.
Why do bodybuilders eat every 2 or 3 hours if that's the case?
I think it goes, well, first of all, if you're looking to gain mass, there's a benefit to it, because it's just hard to get very large meals. If I say eat 2,000, you know, 1500 calories, a lot of people have trouble downing that in a single meal. It's just easier to get more calories in. During the cut, again, it's another myth, but there was this myth that if you ate every few hours, you would stave off the hunger, the starvation response.
Okay.
And that you would then, basically there was this myth that if you go long periods without eating, that the body senses starvation and slows its metabolism down. And that really has not been, that's again where science can trump practical experience, that it just doesn't show that.
And that's why I like both. And that's kind of why I like having people like you on, so they can help clarify these things. One of the things I always thought was you shouldn't go longer than 3 hours though eating, because I thought then your body would become catabolic. So you're telling me 4 or 5 hours is more reasonable.
Yeah. Now, if you're just going to have a whey protein shake, then you're going to need, that's where the higher frequency would be a benefit.
Yeah.
But if you're having a mixed meal where you're having, let's say, some fats, some carbs and protein, mm-hmm. the transit through the gut, it just takes a while to get all the nutrients assimilated, absorbed through the gut and then into the system. And I mean, it's been well studied in about 4 to 6 hours, 4 to 5, 4 to 6 hours, depending on the size of the meal and the composition.
So like you said, then really this whole 6 meals a day, 7 meals a day thing boils down to, I got to get 4,000 calories in a day. I better break them up into smaller meals so I can do it.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. I want to go from that to gut health. Can you help people with gut health? Because there seems to be a growing number of people who are very interested in gut health and how to cure their own issues. And I don't know if this is related to how much we're eating or if it's related to the processed foods we're eating or if it's anabolics have something to do with it or if it's supplementation.
So yeah, gut health is a very interesting issue. And it's been, there's a lot of studies on it, but we still don't have a great understanding at this point. So there's something called a FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P, mm-hmm. Where you take in, and there's specific foods, you can just Google FODMAP.
Yeah.
It's been well studied as a treatment per se for those who have gut issues. And it's taking in certain types of foods like legumes, so beans, certain types of fruits and veggies, milk, yogurt's a biggie. There are probiotics and prebiotics that you could take. So taking in like yogurt is a probiotic it's been very well studied. Now, again, everyone, when we talk about gut health, people are different. And that's why when I think that would be a topic unto itself for an entire podcast, because it really depends upon what the person's issues are. So someone could have, let's say, celiac disease, which is a known condition, but only a very small percentage of people have. If you do have celiac disease, you're going to need to stay away from wheat. You might have lactose intolerance that causes gut health. A lot more people have lactose issues. Mm-hmm. So again, it really would depend upon what the cause is. And you can't really give a cookie cutter answer on something. Yeah.
I guess what I'm getting at is a lot of bodybuilders end up, as they get older, and myself included, end up with more bloating issues or harder to digest foods that they used to digest very easily. Like for me, my gut's very sensitive to foods that used to be no problem to digest. So what is it, just the amount of food that we're eating that's taking a toll on our bodies, or is there something we can do to help mitigate that?
Now, I'm not up on the mechanistic aspects of it. I haven't looked into the causality factors. I've more looked at the treatment, the applied aspects of it. Mm-hmm. From what I do know, you can get allergies. So basically through eating over time, you can develop allergies. And look, what I would say is that if you're experiencing some gut health issue, the first thing I would recommend is going to a doctor and getting getting tested for food allergies to try to localize what your issue is. If you just try to treat it by yourself, basically you're spitting in the dark, you have no idea where that is going.
I think a lot of people try and do like an elimination type diet where they just start taking things away and seeing what might help. So that's kind of the first thing people do.
You can do that, but that can be a long process. So that's again, kind of where I think if you go to a qualified physician, you get a test within a very short period of time, you can find out whether there is a specific allergy. And look, that's always an option. If they can't localize what they think it is, then you can resort to that. But I go for the quickest answer possible. Mm-hmm. And an allergy test to me would be the first line of defense there.
So I want to turn to training. People are constantly asking me about training splits. And they're like, is this split better than that split? Is the, you know, push-pull legs? Should I do the bro split, one body part a day? And I don't know when this became so prevalent, because I've been bodybuilding for 20 plus years. And for some reason, in the last 2 to 3 years, it seems to be the most pressing question. Does it matter?
No. There is no such thing as a best split. When we talk about splits, it really is going to come down to how what your individual needs are. So like when I work with competitive bodybuilders, I would look at what your weak points are and try to devise splits, because I'm a fan, and again, it's not been well studied, but I believe that we have a amount of volume. Everyone has a specific amount of volume that they can accomplish without really devolving into overtraining. But that's a total amount of volume. We shouldn't be looking at volume based upon every body part should have the same volume. You can give more volume to weaker muscle groups, which I advocate, and less volume to a muscle group. If your biceps are a real strong point, why would you be hammering them with a lot of volume? It just doesn't make sense. You want to save up that volume for the muscle groups that are weaker points. And then you'd want to, the way I approach it, is to try to have more frequency. So you then structure your split so that, let's say your hamstrings were a weak point, I'd look to maybe do hamstrings 3 times a week, where you're doing other body parts once a week, and you'd want your split to be able to accommodate mm-hmm. how you're factoring that in. And again, that would be very individual. There is, I would say, again, not well studied, but just based upon the evidence we do have, and just any scientific rationale that you can come up with, there's no such thing as a best split. It's individual, like most of these things.
So, but there is a better split for somebody who, if they want to target something, like you said, if they want to target. So let me ask you, can somebody do hamstrings 3 times a week and it be beneficial?
Sure. I have done that. As a matter of fact, I worked with a competitive bodybuilder, just got his pro card a little over a year ago in classic physique, Joe Tolvi, great bodybuilder. Okay. It's exactly the structure we used. He had two weak points. It was his middle delts and his hamstrings. And both of them, we looked to increase his volume substantially, and to, number one, do them 3 times per week. So it's actually 3 times over a 9-day. We actually start, it doesn't, okay. There's nothing magical about a week either. So we structured a split over, it was a 4-day split. So it was over a 9-day period. So it was 3 times per 9 days. And again, one of the issues is you don't want to have too much volume in a given session. That's where you can kind of waste volume. So if you're doing more than, let's say, 10 sets for a given muscle group, you start to get into that issue where you're not going to be able to increase your protein synthetic response for that muscle group. And that's why then spacing out that training over time gives you that ability to have more volume over a given time period.
Can you explain that to me? How does doing more than 10 sets, and yeah, I'm assuming you're talking 10 working sets.
Correct.
How is doing more than 10 working sets interfere with the protein synthesis?
Well, it doesn't interfere with it. It's just, so you think of it as a curve. So you do one set, you're going to get this amount of protein synthesis.
Yeah.
It's not if you could do 20 sets and you just keep getting more protein. But the protein synthetic response, it's not a linear line where it just keeps going up. Sure. As you keep doing more sets in a given workout, and this has actually been shown. I mean, this is where, again, research can, this is where you use research to guide practice. And it's shown that you get a big spike for the first set, you know, somewhat bigger spike, and then it starts to level off. And that leveling off point, it's not exact. And again, it's going to be somewhat different for inter-individuals. But from what we have seen, it seems to be in that 8 to 10 working sets per muscle group.
Does taking steroids change that? number?
That has never been studied, and it very well could.
Well, I'm not asking these. Sorry to interrupt you. I'm not asking to be argumentative. I'm asking because somebody listening would say, well, that what you just said makes perfect sense for somebody like Dorian Yates, who does low volume. He gets the protein response and goes home. But it doesn't make sense for somebody like Jay Cutler, who says he did 20 sets for every body part. So I'm asking that if the only reason I asked about the steroid question is I'm wondering if this kind of changes that protein response.
It certainly could. So does it? It's never been studied. We don't have studies in competitive bodybuilders. And by the way, when we're talking pro bodybuilders, they're taking, so let's say I had a study of someone taking steroids. That would not necessarily mimic what I won't even use Jay Cutler, but let's say a given bodybuilder who's doing GH and IGF. Yeah. And I mean, the pharmacological dosages that they're using are just so beyond what you'd ever see.
Sure.
In some of them, at least. Yeah. That trying to guide practice within things like that is impossible. And I would say that that's where, again, I can give generalized recommendations, but that's where you have to use your N equals one.
Okay. So what is too much volume? Like first you said frequency, which is important, but then you said volume. So more than 10 sets is too much volume. What is too much frequency? Like how many times?
When you say volume per session.
Per session, yeah. But what I'm saying is I personally wouldn't do hamstrings 3 times a week because I would still be sore from the time before. So, or in 9 days, I guess. So does soreness matter? It doesn't matter.
No. So you can train when you're sore. Now, if the soreness is preventing you from training properly, then that's going to matter. If you're just sore and you could get a great workout in, there's no detriment to training while you're sore. Soreness has the actual mechanistic aspects of soreness has to do, they talk about muscle damage, but in a highly trained lifter, it tends to be more in what's called the extracellular matrix, which is a supporting structure within muscle, it seems, at least the evidence we have. But if you're too sore to move, I would say then, that's going to be a big problem. And then you have to then work around how you're going to train needs to be worked around that. But just being sore by itself is not going to affect your muscle protein synthetic response.
So this has got to be a bro science-y thing for sure. But I always assume that if you're sore, the muscle was still damaged, and that was your body basically telling you to wait. And you're saying that I can go ahead and go through it, because one of the things that always scared me was if I'm sore and I train, one, am I preventing the muscle from growing as much as it can? And two, am I risking injury because I'm overtraining a muscle because it's still sore?
And again, that would really be, it's not a yes or no question. It would have to do with the degree to which you were sore.
Yeah.
So if you're, let's say in 3 days, if you were still really sore, then you're not going to want to train. Then there could be, then that would be a negative effect. If you feel some soreness, because usually soreness in a high level bodybuilder, now you might be just ultra sensitive to that, but in the vast majority of athletes, high level athletes I've worked with, it's for 24 to 48 hours is where your maximal soreness comes in.
Yeah.
And then by that 72 hour period, it's pretty much mitigated.
Yeah, it depends. I've had some leg days where I was like 3 days later, still having a tough time walking.
Then you'd have to, then
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that would be where it's individual and you'd have to, I would not then recommend if you're, because it's, if nothing else, whether that's going to impair your protein synthetic response, it's going to impair your ability to train with a high degree of intensity. And that in itself would be a negative for someone, especially at your level.
Well, that leads me to another question, which is how much is too much? Like if I'm sore for like I remember there would be periods in my career, like years at a time where after a leg day, I would be sore for 6 days and just be better in time for the seventh day. Like when I was ready to get back to the gym, like ready to get back for leg day. So is that too, like, is there a place where it's too much? Like if somebody's sore for 5, 6, like, is it like, hey, you need to pull back a little bit?
So let me ask you this. Were you changing your workouts frequently from one workout to the next?
My workouts always change, but not dramatically. Like staples are there. Like for a leg workout, there's always going to be a squat, a leg press, a hack squat. They might change the order, or I might change the rep ranges might change a little bit, but maybe some intensity techniques might change, but the staple exercises are there.
That's interesting because generally speaking, where advanced bodybuilders and lifters get more sore is when they're changing around their workouts. Let's say you're doing squats one session, it's squat and leg extension and lunge. Then the next one, you're going to do a leg press and a sissy squat. And that's usually because the movement patterns are somewhat different and the recruitment patterns. That's where you'd see. Now, if you're doing the same workout, because that was one thing I might suggest, is that you don't use as much variety. You don't change your exercises as much. If you're experiencing the, again, it's very individual how people experience soreness. Is there a detriment to it? Yeah, because it's going to prevent you from being able to train again. And now, obviously, you experience great success with it. Could you have experienced, the question is, could you have experienced better success if you did something different? And that's a question that we'd have to discuss often.
Well, no, I mean, I guess the real question I'm trying to get to is for people listening, because there's a lot of young lifters that are listening to this and they're trying to find their way. And I always thought when I was younger was just the harder I could go, the better. So I would be doing the same exercises, but I just made sure I went harder every week. And I was just continuously sore day after day, week after week. And I don't think it was right. So I guess the question I'm trying to get to is there a way to measure how hard you're pushing? And is there a place that's too far? Like you've gone too far. You need to pull back a little bit. Like if somebody's experiencing soreness for 5 days, could it be that they're not necessarily super sensitive, but could it be just be that they're doing too much?
Yeah, absolutely. It could be. So, I used to be a more of a proponent of you got to push. As I've gotten more experienced and worked with a broader range of lifters over many years, as you can probably tell, and as well as gotten more into research, I've gotten much more conservative with the use of failure training. And I think one of the things that I would probably suggest, are you familiar with the repetitions in reserve?
Yeah, me and John just talked about that. RIR.
Yeah. So my general sense would be in recommendations were do RIRs of 1 to 2 on a majority of your working sets and only push to failure, let's say on your last set or maybe your last two. Some of that is dependent upon cycling, how you're let's say a mesocycle and how you're structuring your training over time.
Yeah.
But if you're pushing to failure, let's say on 10 working sets over time, you might just be overdoing it at that point or more. And that would be something certainly I think that would need to be looked at.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I actually think that is the answer because in my earlier days, I would go to failure on all my sets. So that was probably the main problem.
And by the way, that was the bodybuilder that I told you about, Joe Tovey. That was one of the things I had to do because he had that mindset. And I was like, Joe, we got to pull you back from that ledge. You can't, because for him, if he wasn't not only going all out to failure, but then getting forced reps. He wasn't training hard enough. And when we increased the frequency, I said, Joe, we're going to, you need to selectively use failure more often now. We need to balance it. And I can tell you, I can show you pictures, but he brought his hamstrings up nicely and won his pro card.
Yeah. It's such a fine line for people because we stress, on this podcast and, everybody else on their own Instagrams stresses that you should be train harder. But then at the same time, we're saying, don't train too hard. Like make sure, you know what I mean? So it's like a really fine line between growing and, going backwards because you did too much.
You need to train hard and you need to train smart. So the two are not mutually exclusive. Too much of anything is too much water you can die from.
Yeah.
So again, it's you do want to train hard. You also have people say, I never go to failure. I mean, it would depend on the person. I am certainly a believer that as you really get to the upper levels of bodybuilding, there's a need to really push yourself. And if not, you're not going to, because you're getting close to that genetic ceiling to really tap into that genetic ceiling. I'm a believer that you need to have some training that is to failure, but I think a lot of bodybuilders tend to overdo it.
Now, where do you stand on doing less like that? The saying that less is more, and I don't mean in a training session, but in a training split. Like, I've talked to people who think doing 4 days a week is actually more beneficial than doing 5 or 6 because more rest days. It's kind of like torture the muscle for the day and then take time off instead of that repeated, you know, the high frequency stuff. I don't know where I really stand on that. I know I work with John Meadows for a long time, and I did 6 days a week for a really long time for a few years, and I had great benefit from it. But you also listen to people like Dorian Yates and people of that thought process that say less is going to get you bigger faster.
Yeah. So again, when it comes to a split, I think first of all, it's individual. I also don't think we should look at splits as being, this is my split and this is what I do for the year. Mm-hmm. I think that you should really look at training in terms of blocks. So let's say you're going to have a 6 month period. You can have a 2 month block, another 2 month block, and another 2 month block where you structure your workouts, and you have basically, you plan your splits up. You plan your training cycles over that period of time. And that would change based upon what your goals are leading up, let's say, to a competition or whatever it is you're going to do. So having static thought processes, I think, is one of the misguided things that I think too many lifters fall into, that it's this or that when it could be combinations of this and that.
But I don't mean, okay, let's assume we're going to work in phases. Is a phase of 4 days a week beneficial, or is it too little?
Well, again, when you say a phase of four, is it four over what period of time, a week?
Well, how long would you think a phase would be good for? Like, if somebody's going to do...
The frequency. So you're saying, could it be a 4 day split, 1 day off, then four more days? Are you talking about within a week span that you're doing, let's say?
I'm saying within a week, training 4 days only.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if I was going to do that, I know Dorian was big. That was Dorian's split.
Yeah.
I personally use splits like that, doing upper body, lower body type splits, where I do upper one day, where you actually get to work out twice a week. Now, a lot of that, again, depends. Again, having a fixed thought, especially with a advanced bodybuilder, I'm also a believer that some muscle groups might need 1 day a week and some might need more. So you might have some muscles doing 2 days a week, some might are doing three, and some might are doing one. So again, looking at it in that context, I think is somewhat misguided. You have a structure, and then you need to look at what your strong points and your weak points are and say, I think this I can get away with doing once a week. This Mike Matarazzo, if you probably remember, guy had one of the best set of calves in bodybuilding, never trained his calves. So there were certain genetic muscles that you just don't need, and that would take away from your, if you don't train it, then you have more volume. I think of volume as a budget. So you look at, you know, this is the amount that I have to spend on volume. If I don't have to train that, I can spend more sets on other muscle groups.
When you spoke about training in phases, I wanted to get to one of the papers that you posted on your Instagram, talked about strength and having strength phases before hypertrophy phases. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get into that, because there's a common thought that strength isn't relevant, and that you can get big by lifting light weights. And that study kind of pretty much disproved that thought. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the study had some limitations to it, but I would say that I am a fan of that thought process, because, so again, it comes down to conceptually, that study did was kind of a proof of principle study, which did lend, when we look at studies, we don't want to say it proves, or sometimes you can disprove, but it doesn't really prove anything. It lends support to a given theory. And that helped to, again, I would say we need a lot more research before I would be comfortable in saying this is something I completely buy into. But I've been an advocate of that. And here's the reason. Mm-hmm. That, let's say your focus is going to be on moderate to lighter loads, and that's going to get you more volume. If you have a pre-phase of doing strength work, that's going to allow you to use heavier loads during your moderate load training. So let's say you're, let's say you can generally do 100-pound dumbbell presses, dumbbell presses for 10 reps. If you preceded that with a strength phase, you might be able to do 110 pounds. when you got to that moderate phase. Yeah. That then is going to create more mechanical tension during your strength phase. We know that mechanical tension is the primary driver of hypertrophy. And thus it just, there has a logical basis to it. Whether it does pan out, that study seemed to suggest that it does. But I think that it's a good, it has good practical value.
So you said mechanical tension is the main driver in hypertrophy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that saying basically that the more you can lift, the bigger you're going to get? I mean, that's kind of, I mean, the more you can lift, the more tension you're going to create, right?
Well, that's where it starts to get somewhat hazy. So at a given rep range, yeah. So let's say if I lifted 10 reps at 100 pounds versus lifting 10 reps at 110 pounds, yes. But what if I lifted 100 pounds instead of doing 110, let's say instead of going for 10 reps, I was able to get 12 reps with that. You're then again getting more mechanical tension because you're doing more work within that given set.
Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be using heavier loads. There's actually very compelling evidence that you can get very similar growth using lighter loads versus heavier loads, that the amount of load lifted, but that is predicated on training to fatigue or at least close to fatigue.
Okay.
So if you lifted a lighter load at and you're going far from failure, then you're going to have less mechanical tension.
Right.
The reason that it seems to pan out is that you're creating the mechanical tension by going towards failure or close to failure.
So the reason heavy works, and heavy is a relative term, obviously, but the reason heavy works is because you're able to fail.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I can lift 20 pound dumbbells for 3 hours and not get tired, right? But 100 pound dumbbell and I'm done. So, so the heavy matters because you're trying to fail. And you don't want to, does it matter if I fail at 25 reps or if I fail at 10?
That's the whole point is no. So I actually carried out a study in well-trained bodybuilders, well, not bodybuilders, but well-trained lifters. They weren't your caliber, but I mean, they were 3-4 years of consistent lifting experience. So I would say they are intermediate. I would call them intermediate lifters, you know, not hardcore bodybuilders, but we put one group doing 10 reps to failure, 8 to 12 reps. The other group did 25 to 35 reps to failure.
Okay.
We had them do a total body routine 3 days a week, zero difference in their muscle growth. We looked at biceps, triceps, quads.
And, that's crazy to think. So that basically means I could squat, you know, 135 pounds for 30 reps, say, and fail at 30 or 40, whatever it may be. And then I can do 405 for 10 reps. And those, the muscle gain I'm going to get from both is equal.
That is correct. Now there could be a caveat to this. There has been some talk that I assume you're familiar with different fiber types, type one versus type two fibers. So you're, for those who don't know in the audience, type one fibers are your endurance oriented fibers. They don't have as great growth potential, but they can basically, they can go on for long periods of time. Whereas your type two fibers, they're your strength oriented fibers. They have a somewhat greater growth potential than your type ones, but they fatigue more easily.
Sure.
There is some, there is a theory and there's some evidence to show that you might get greater growth in your type one fibers with your lighter loads and greater growth in your type two fibers with your heavier loads, which would lend, if true, that would mean that it would be beneficial to do some light load training and some heavier load training to get all your fibers maximized. Yeah. We recently carried out a study that did not seem to support that, the fiber response seemed to be equal. But I'd say we still need more research to get a better handle. And I would say, again, without knowing, it probably makes sense. And I'm, again, an advocate of this. Without knowing when there might be a benefit, do some light load training, do some heavier load training. And that way you, it's not going to hurt you and it could help in terms of optimizing the fiber type specific response.
How do we know, is there a way to know how many type one, type two fibers that we have?
Biopsy.
So, but like how seriously, like I can go to the doctor and get a biopsy and he can tell me?
Yeah.
But I have to get a biopsy of each muscle. It's not like one.
That's correct. Yeah. Now, generally speaking, most people are fiber type specific. So the people who are type two dominant tend to be type two dominant in most muscles,
yeah.
You know, in the major muscles where you're type, but you know what, Fuad? It's not going to change much anyway.
Yeah.
let's say you found out that you were 65%, 35%. You know, you're still going to have a substantial amount of type 1 fibers and need to work them. So people make a lot about that, but I don't think it really means much.
It's there has to be some other factors, don't you think, though? I mean, it just sounds crazy to me. It's very hard for me to wrap my mind around the fact that I could do one plate versus four and still gain the same amount of size. Is there any other factors that could be playing a part in that?
Again, it seems to be the mechanical tension aspect, that when you start getting heavier, so let's say I'm doing a set of 30. So you said, let's say squats at 135 pounds for 30 reps.
Yeah.
On your 10th rep, you could, that's going up like butter.
Yeah.
As you're going to your 20th rep, you're starting to move a little bit slower. It's starting to get harder. What's happening there is you're starting to force recruitment of more and more type higher threshold motor units, which are your type two fibers. And as you start getting higher and higher, let's say your 25th rep, 26th, 27th, these fibers are coming in, the higher threshold units are coming into play to a greater extent. Now, could it be you're cycling the type one motor units, type one muscle fibers again more? This is where, again, science has not been able to really to tell us this. Anything else would be speculation, but it seems that the mechanical tension aspect in the recruitment is responsible for the majority of it.
Okay. I do have one more thing I want to ask about this and then I'll let it go, but I just have to ask, I've done the things you're saying, like I've done lightweight workouts with a lot of reps, sometimes for legs or for any body part I've done them. And I get really sore for a day, right? But there's a difference, and I'm sure anybody out there who's, and even yourself, if you've trained, like if you've purposely gone in to try and train as heavy as you can, there's a deeper soreness. I guess I could say it's a different feeling. Like the next day after, the muscle feels more full. Like my legs will remain full for 2-3 days after a heavy leg day versus that lighter workout. The lighter workout still got me sore, still felt a lot of pain, but it kind of went away in a day, where the heavier workout lasted longer. Is there any explanation for that, or is that just in my head?
Well, there does seem to be more muscle damage from heavier load training.
Okay.
So that very well, again, it's without getting, without doing scans of you and knowing exactly what's going on. But certainly there would be the logical rationale is that heavier load training does seem to cause more muscle damage than lighter load training.
Okay. So is when we say more muscle damage, it means we're going to grow more if we're eating properly.
Not necessarily. So damage, that's again, another good question, which there is some evidence that damage might be involved in the response, but that is not clear at this point. But you also get more what's called metabolic stress with the higher rep training workout, and that is another mechanism. So could those mechanisms be synergistic, where doing both again would benefit? There is some, there's been a few studies that have shown that the signaling, so again, I don't know how technical you want to get with this, but
it's okay. I'll try and follow along.
Yeah. Muscle development is predicated on what's called intracellular signaling. Okay. So there's an enzymatic cascade that causes protein synthesis. So there's a series of enzymes that are signaled from, it's called mechanosensor, mechanosignaling. And you have these mechanosensors, so the body, the muscles sense a stimulus, which is lifting. So that's your mechanical tension. Then it's going to convert the mechanical signals into chemical signals.
Okay.
And it goes through. So anyway, to make a long story short, we have different pathways, different intracellular anabolic signaling pathways. And there is some evidence that the pathways with heavier load training are different. We have different anabolic pathways that are initiated through heavier load training than light load training. Could that be then where you get, again, a synergism from training some heavier load and some lighter load?
Mm-hmm.
It's speculative. We don't know. You can't necessarily take an acute evidence like that and look at signaling and say, well, that's necessarily going to cause more muscle growth. I could speculate it might.
Yeah.
But again, here's where we need to just say there might be a benefit to it. There doesn't seem to be any downside. So if I'm a high level bodybuilder or coaching a high level bodybuilder, I'm going to say, you know what, this is a sound strategy. So we should have some work in here that's going to look at light loads. And you can focus my general, the way I approach it is that I look to do lighter loads on your single joint movements. Because if you've ever done squats with a set of 30 with squats, I mean, you are winded and it's, I mean, in the study we did, they puked. I mean, the a majority of the subjects in the first week just were puking. But doing it more on the, it's, there's less stress again in the single joint movements, let's say a leg extension, biceps curls, where your compound movements, you're using more of the heavier load. And there's a synergism there and potentially a benefit towards growth.
Yeah. Can you, this might be a silly question, but can you explain the difference between metabolic stress and muscle damage?
Yeah, sure.
Where, what is the difference between the, because I'm trying to follow along here and I'm not sure where those differ.
Yeah. Metabolic stress is an acute phenomenon. So that means you're experiencing it during a, during the workout itself.
Okay.
And metabolic stress is the accumulation of metabolites, which are breakdown products from substances within the body. The primary one that we look at is lactic acid. So lactic acid is going to be a metabolite. So we know that when you're doing, let's say, a very high repetition set, you're going to feel the burn. When you feel the burn, that's where you're building up metabolic stress. You're building up metabolites, particularly lactic acid.
Okay.
And there is some evidence that lactate itself is a, it has intracellular signaling and mechanosensoring abilities. Okay. And this might have anabolic effects. Whereas muscle damage, you actually see that after you, while it's developing during the workout, the experience of that happens post-workout. Whereas metabolic stress, the effects of that are gone within a few minutes, you know, certainly an hour after a workout. The effects of the metabolic stress, the metabolites are going to be cleared. Whereas muscle damage has, basically that has to do with micro tears within the muscle structures, whether the cell membrane, like I talked about before, the extracellular matrix, which is a connective tissue within the muscle, the structures within the muscle itself. So they're just different mechanisms.
So I think when most people, correct me if I'm wrong, I think most people, when they think of muscle growth, they think of muscle damage. They think of the damage they did during their workout, and that's what's going to make them grow. But you're saying the metabolic stress is also part of that.
Well, metabolic stress is separate from muscle damage.
But
so there's three, there's, and I actually published a paper on this years ago, talking about the three primary, at least hypothetical factors involved in hypertrophy, and mechanical tension is the overall driver, but that muscle damage and metabolic stress might be synergistic. Again, that's where we need more evidence. There's some evidence showing they are, there's some evidence showing they aren't. I will say this, and you kind of hit on this before, too much muscle damage is a negative. So, and that's why when people walk in, they tend to equate muscle damage, or a lot of bodybuilders do, with muscle growth. So they want to walk out like Frankenstein, you know, I can't put my arms down and I'm walking out, I can't walk properly. That is doing too much. When you're doing that, basically you're impairing your ability to train properly. The body then has to repair that damage, and it's not going to repair it in time for you to synthesize muscle proteins well enough. But there could be other factors, and again, don't want to get too technical, but there's something called satellite cells. Muscle damage activates something called satellite cells, which are promoters of growth. Now, how that factors into the equation or the additive or not, still not clear. The idea would be that there's kind of a sweet spot to muscle damage. You want to have some muscle damage, but not too much to maximize the muscle hypertrophic response.
This goes back to something John told me a long time ago, is you want to, if you dig the hole too deep, it's going to take you too long to get out of it. So he's like, train just hard enough so that you can get back the next day, which is kind of what you've been saying all along.
And so I not to interrupt, but I do want to just say that John Meadows to me is the epitome of a really top Flight Pro. Like he takes the science, as we talked about before, he delves into the science, he understands the basic science, but he has that experience and he looks at the individuals. He doesn't do the canned program thing. So yep. He just has a really great sense of using his expertise in combination what we know through literature to develop programs.
Yeah, I think John's kind of changed my thinking a lot. I started working with him in 2014 and John was the one who taught me that the science is important, but sometimes you can't explain everything that happens in the gym. So he's kind of the one who got me on that. The same thing, which we've been saying all along, really, is that use the science as a guide, but it's not the be all end all. So that's kind of John's influence on me. But I don't want to keep you too long. The last thing I want to cover before you go is the pump. How important is the pump? Because I hear people say, you can still grow muscle without a pump. You can still get big without a pump. The pump doesn't matter. The pump is just a feeling. But I don't know if I disagree with any of that, but how much bigger am I going to get if I can get a pump?
So it's funny you say that. The pump really is a function of metabolic stress.
Yeah.
If you get, and that's why it's not clear. So can you just train, if you train with, let's say three to five reps, you're not going to get a pump because there's very little metabolic stress. There's very little buildup of metabolites in the muscle and basically hyperemia. So your lactic acid, the lactate itself tends to draw fluid in because it's what's called an osmolyte that draws mm-hmm. fluid into the muscle and it's temporary. There is some evidence that reactive hyperemia, that flow of blood into the muscle through the metabolic stress initiative, if you will, is a driver of hypertrophy. Is it? We still don't know. But there is some, again, some evidence that it could be. And that's why, again, I say that some training should be done with higher reps to get that pump.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you basically said earlier in our conversation that the metabolic stress and muscle damage they work synergistically kind of to give us what we call muscle growth or hypertrophy. So you kind of do need the pump. You don't need it to get big, but you're going to get bigger with it.
So there's some really good research in test tubes that show that what's called cellular hydration. So hydration is fluid. Yeah. If you hydrate a cell, and that's what the pump is, that's where you're getting fluid within the muscle.
Yeah. So
you're basically drawing the fluid that goes in the what's called the interstitial spaces back into the muscle. There's some really great test tube research showing that if you take a cell, and this has been done in it's been done in liver cells and kidney cells and muscle cells, where if you hydrate the cell, you get an increase in protein synthesis and a decrease in protein breakdown. Okay. That is a hypertrophic home run. The question is, does that translate into what's called in vivo, in the living, in actual practice? And you can't necessarily take what you see in the test tube and then extrapolate that. But it does gives us a basis by which it very well might, where the pump might have benefits. And the theory, I'll give you the logical rationale. You could think of it as, let's say you're blowing up a water balloon, where if you blow up a water balloon, if you blow it up too much, the water balloon is going to explode. Well, the muscle, when it gets that pump, there's pressure against the cell wall and it wants to protect itself. The body, the only thing the body cares about is survival. Mm-hmm. So the hypothetical rationale, the theoretical rationale, is that when you get this pump, the muscle starts to sense a threat to its survival, that it's its ultrastructure is being challenged by this pressure coming on it, and it's going to then produce proteins to reinforce its structure.
Okay. So I can go around and tell everybody that you need a pump to get big because you said it happens in a test tube.
Right. You could tell them that it might.
I could tell them it might. Okay. Okay. Brad, I could ask you a million questions. We've been on for a little while. I want to give you a chance to say, is there anything you want to say? Is there any myths or anything any message you want to kind of put out before we end the podcast?
I think kind of pulling it full circle back into what we discussed at the beginning. One of my real messages is that we need to come together in the fitness field and There's this theory by some lifters, bodybuilders, that researchers are white lab coats who never lift. And there's a theory and there's this thought by some researchers that all bodybuilders and strength coaches are meatheads who don't understand what research has. Yeah. Really, we are synergistic, and that if you want to optimize your results, those who are bodybuilders and strength coaches need to get an appreciation for research, and researchers need to realize that bodybuilders know a thing or two about getting big.
Yeah.
And that and they have to understand that there's a lot of limitations, and unfortunately there are researchers that should know this and don't, and that by coming together as a field, we can enhance this effect and ultimately bring the field forward.
Yeah.
And make bigger, stronger individuals.
I think if I can just add to that, I think it's nice to, I feel like nowadays more bodybuilders are open to listening to science.
Agreed.
We still, I think all of us as a whole still don't, you know, we don't look at all the studies and say, oh, we got to do this. We still learn from each other in the gym. But I think when someone like you comes on and says, hey, this is how it works, I don't feel like we're as closed off to listening to what you're saying and trying to use it in our own strategy, in our own programs. So I think things are changing. I think it's better. I actually feel like there's more of an argument amongst scientists now than there is amongst bodybuilders and scientists. Because now you have this guy says keto, this guy says carnivore, this guy says, and now I feel like scientists are fighting, but bodybuilders over here going, okay, we can listen to it all. And I think most of us, most of the guys that I talk to anyway, are appreciative for any added help that we can use to make ourselves better.
Yeah, look, I was a natty bodybuilder. I was an ectomorph with, you know, not the greatest of genetics, and utilizing science, I was able to win my class multiple times as a natty bodybuilder. And I never took it past that. But that has fueled my drive to understand the science and then hopefully try to educate people on the abilities you can get if you're able to harness that and then use your own expertise. So people like you and John Meadows and some others, it just is really great to see that you not only embrace it, but that you get people like me on and help to bring that out to the masses.
Before you go, really quickly, what got you into the field?
Basically, that was it. I was a skinny kid. I came out of college and I was, real thin, very unhappy with my physique. I found bodybuilding. And then once I got hooked, I decided on a career change. It just fueled me. And first of all, it completely changed my psyche in terms of how I felt about myself. But once I started getting then into the science and seeing how I can, all right, I started trying to use the, I'd open up this will date me, but I went back to the time where Flex, I'd get Flex as a subscription in the mail.
Yeah.
I'd go and I'd try to do the workouts of my favorite bodybuilders back then, who were like Lee Haney and the Lee Labrada. So we're talking the 90, you know, the
90s, late 80s,
and late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And I plateaued from there. You know, I was basically, I didn't have their genetics or their gear. I ultimately had to N=1 and then look into research. So the more I then started getting into literature and then keep taking that forward, the more I was able to maximize my own results. So
you didn't actually study this in school, like in your college the first time?
No, I actually was a business major. And then I went back to school and got my master's in exercise science and then my PhD.
Interesting.
So I was a business, and then I had to take leveling courses, meaning, you know, courses in exercise science and physiology.
Yeah. So how long?
To get my master's.
How long did you go to school total? How many years?
Well, my college was 4 years, master's was 2, and then my PhD was 3.5. So a lot of school.
Huh. And you wrote a book, actually, before you go. I want to, for everybody listening, if you have a minute, go and follow Brad's page, Brad Schoenfeld, PhD. And you wrote a book called The Max Muscle Plan in Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy.
Correct. Yeah, Max Muscle Plan is a consumer book. Science and Development of Muscle Hypertrophy is a textbook. So if you want to really get into the science, then you go to the text. That's the textbook.
Okay. So what does the textbook do? All the learning, obviously.
It gets really into detail about some of the stuff like the intracellular signaling, muscle damage, metabolic stress. I Shoot me an email. I'll send you a copy.
Okay. What about, you said the other part was, what was the other part? The Max Muscle Plan is
Max
what?
Max Muscle Plan. Now that's a consumer book. I would say hold off on buying that because I have a second edition of that coming out at the end of this year. That book is quite dated now. That's 10 years old. So I think it's being released in November, the new edition of that.
Okay.
So give it a wait. And if you're interested, that'll be a really cool book.
Okay, Brad, I'm going to put together over the course of a little bit of time, I'm going to put together a whole bunch of more myths that I keep getting in my DMs. And hopefully you'll come back on and we can dispel them.
That'd be awesome.
Okay, Brad. Thank you very much, man. Have a good day. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.